So, all right, welcome everybody. I'm Daniel Foley from the Abundant Life Training Center. And today I've got a special guest, Leanne Pearson Morrell. And interesting story how we actually met. Originally, I was getting ready for my gym. We were getting ready to have our kind of annual meeting where we discuss vision and goals for the year. And one of the pastors that I was training in my gym sent me an email, and he didn't know anything about the meeting at all. He said, "Hey, you're getting ready to have a meeting next week." I think it was on Tuesday at 2 p.m. And he even named the place. And he said, "We have a lady in our church that's a business consultant. She's supposed to help you." So I'm like, "Well, we're having that meeting, so give me her contact info." So that's kind of how Leanne and I met. And she, I would say, shares a similar vision for this. The John 10:10, life abundantly. She shares a similar vision for that. So we've had some good conversations around that. But she is, I would say, one of the best people I know for combining the concepts of business, but also concepts of biblical principles and the kingdom of God, and kind of how those things fit together. How do we do? And she might even address the way I say this, maybe. But how do we do business in a kingdom way that's honoring God and going forth? But Leanne, welcome on board here. Do you want to give us just a quick background, a little bit of kind of your experience in business and how this all came about?
Absolutely. Thanks, Daniel. First of all, it's incredible to be here, because I think it's a testimony of how God weaves things together that you just can't even imagine, how paths crisscross and he really brings like-heartedness together, I think, mm-hmm. so that he can expand and multiply. And we'll talk about that a little bit today. But I think that's one of the reasons why I'm so excited, is just to come alongside you, Daniel, and those of that are listening to this, of just really wanting to see the flourishing, the abundance that has been promised to us. So my background, kind of the cliff notes of my background, is I always joke around that I'm just a kid from Montana, that God decided to turn her world upside down to get her attention. I landed in Atlanta when I was in my early 20s. Was very idealistic, believing I was going to go get my MBA. I was very interested in business and communications, and had kind of an international mind even then of what would it be like to go overseas and really kind of work with international companies. I ended up doing some volunteer work at a ministry in the inner city of Atlanta. And I thought, oh, okay, I'm going to just work out all my social justice in one summer. I'm going to do an internship. And that turned into 10 years. 10 years of ministry, not only in Atlanta, based in Atlanta, but worldwide. In that process, I began to rub shoulders with our board member, very affluent, Christ-centered leaders in Atlanta, some of which are some of the major CEOs that we would know today, of Walmart, Chick-fil-A, that kind of thing. And just had a real privilege of walking alongside of them, but I began to see a gap between wanting to really fulfill what was visions and heart passions on people, and then also the practical best practices of how to run an organization. I began to see the gap even then when I was in full-time ministry. To cut a very long journey short and getting to the point, I ended up working with one of those board members. And that has led me into consulting, not only in nonprofits, but in businesses as well. And in the process, I ended up getting a certification in life coaching and business coaching, just as a tool, really, to be able to leverage and be able to, I would say, with more precision, and impact the organizations and the individuals that I was wanting to be around and wanting to influence. So that leads me to a long story to Virginia. Came up here to be a part of an internship program and really see where God was taking that. And it ended up crisscrossing my paths with business owners here in Blacksburg, and have enjoyed consulting since I ended up getting married and now have a 1-year-old. So that's where I am today.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting you talk about that gap. So there's a lot of people. We can go to Barnes and Noble. We can find all kinds of books on business best practices. We can find all kinds of books on biblical principles, but there's not a lot that marry the two together. And I think there is a gap there. So how do we, what, how do we you know, fix this gap? What's the key to finding that sweet spot there?
I think one place that I've been inspired to, as I've been on a journey of pursuing what we would probably categorize as ministry, business, family life, we get very categorical in our lives, you know, trying to understand each role that we're doing, which is good and healthy. But from a kingdom standpoint, it's a lifestyle. It's more of him and less of me and expressing him in the world. And so it's really his centered on his character and the principles of his character and his nature, that it's glory unto glory. We're expressing what glory is, his thoughts and opinions in the earth. And so I think where the gap really happens is that we get this mindset that business is of the world and other things are of God. Versus, no, we are in a part of the world at all. We are actually citizens of the kingdom. And as citizens of the kingdom, we are not going to see us flourishing or being able to really kind of activate the favor that God has in our life unless we understand the kingdom principles in which we're citizens of. And so I think the gap becomes, as we categorize it, of I just hope God blesses my business and I can do my business, and then I'll use whatever profit I get from my business to go bless what God is doing. And we kind of categorize versus coming into it of, no, this is my lifestyle. I have a kingdom lifestyle, and now I'm going to infuse that into my business, my family, my ministry, the organizations, my relationships, that kind of thing. So coming really at a place of, you know, the foundation is in him, and by being in him, we can begin to project. And that's the reason why I'm a big proponent of we can't build kingdom business. There's no such thing as building a kingdom business. We can infuse kingdom into our businesses and let the glory of God be seen in them. But I think the idea of trying to build a kingdom business is almost setting you up for conflict, because unless you know what a kingdom business really looks like, meaning his kingdom business and his economy, it's very difficult to do that. It's better to take the principles that we have and begin to infuse the character of God in them. So I hope that answered, Daniel.
No, that's good. So it's a different heart stance, mindset, whatever you want to call it, of not separating, oh, this is ministry, this is business. Mm. It's all one and the same. You know, really I'm taking my lifestyle of living in the kingdom and bringing it into everything I do. It sounds like. So what are some of the principles you've learned for kingdom? You know, what are some of these kingdom principles that we can begin to infuse into business?
Sure. I think that the way that I have kind of pursued it and just tried to understand the concepts and the precepts, especially with consulting, right? Coming alongside people and giving them advice and counsel, and wanting to see that flourish, is two sides. One would be structure. What is the structure? Because, you know, when it comes to organizational development, one of the key things is you never want to put in a structure that you have to manage. You want structures that help you manage, that, you know, it's a slight, just a skew a little bit on the compass, right? If you go off and a system begins to be arduous and you have to manage it, then it's of no use. So you want a structure that helps you flourish, scale, grow, multiply. You want to make sure that that structure is in that. So one of the first things to take a look at is, how's the kingdom structured? What are the basics of that kingdom? And then learning the principles of it. So there's kind of two sides to that. One, kind of the big overlook of that is, what sustains God's glory? Where is he? You know, in his throne room, what is sustaining? What are the structures around it? You can get a lot of that in revelation and understanding, and especially in the visions that John had. And then there's other aspects that you can get throughout scripture. But for the most part, you see purity, holy, and light. You know, so there's this place of being really tested and fired. You know, things have to have pressure. We talk about anointing only comes from the pressing in, the squeezing in. So you learn things about the structure of what holds God's glory when you start looking at, you know, the lake of fire, glass, gold, the streets of gold. Well, gold that has been refined is actually transparent, right? So light can go through it. And so when you start looking at these principles, you start looking at, okay, I need a transparent organization. I need one that is tested and true, right? It's gone through the fire and it has character on the other side. It's set apart. It's not where you look and go, you know, I mean, a lot of us, I use the example just being from Atlanta for so long, is Chick-fil-A. There is something about Chick-fil-A that is set apart because they've taken a stance. They've taken a way in which they do their business. So you know that they're set apart for a reason and what they're reasoning and doing. So that's kind of a way that that manifests. The other part of it is just the organizational structure. And Daniel, you and I have talked a lot about this, and I think you were one of the ones that really helped me get the enlightenment around, you know, when you talk about business practices, one of the key entrepreneurial operating systems that you look at is a structure of a visionary to an integrator to three key components: business development, finances, and operation. Well, when you look at that structure, you can actually see the endocrine system of the human body. And we're made in his image. He tells us scripturally to look at creation to be able to see who he is and what he's about and his nature and character. So when you look at the very way that he created our body to function in health and send messages throughout the body so that the body could achieve what it needs to achieve, he chose this endocrine system, which matches so well. You've got the visionary, what is the hypothalamus, catching all the messages coming in. Then you've got the integrator, the pituitary gland, which is doing what? It's making sure it has the key messages, the right messages, and fleshing that out to your hormones, your adrenals, and your thyroid. You know, the hormones telling you when to grow, when not to grow. You know, I often talk about organizations, especially in ones going through entrepreneurial stages, look like teenagers and act like teenagers, right? They want to grow. They want to market themselves. They want to be way before their time, before their body has fully developed. And so they have to pull themselves back and actually monitor what is really going on and get some health. Adrenals, you know, that is that place of just loss and gain. Do you have the finances? Do you have the resources to be able to go do what you need to do? And then the thyroid matches the structural part, that part that is really creating the bone structure, the stamina to be able to handle the weight of what you're doing. So when you look at that, it's amazing to see God's kingdom fleshed out right before our eyes, literally. And yet it is, when you read all the books, it's probably one of the key operational structures that, as in a consultant, business consultant comes in, I look very quickly and you can diagnose what's going on in a business just by looking at those key boxes. Where's the vision coming from? Is the vision just literally circumventing the pituitary gland, right? Circumventing that integrator and just sending all kinds of messages to the body, and the body just doesn't know what to do. It's out of balance. It's fatigued. It's heavy in one area, too light in another. And so you can get a lot of understanding just based on how he designed creation. So I would say that would be one aspect of structure. And the other aspect would be looking at some, you know, just true kingdom principles that you can look at.
Yeah. You know, one of the first things you taught me, you know, one of the main things I remember learning early on in the first couple of meetings was learning this structure, you know, you said the best businesses in the world almost always have a two-person team at the top. They have a visionary person who's looking out where they're going, setting the vision and kind of looking out at where the business is going. And then you have an integrator person who's making it all happen, who's taking that vision and, you know, executing it and making it happen, and overseeing the day-to-day operations of it. And we started to have some discussions like, wait a minute, this looks exactly like the structure that I'm learning about, you know, in our physical bodies of how communication happens in the body. You got a two-person team with the hypothalamus and a pituitary in your body, which pushes to three, you know, major organ adrenal systems and things like that. So can you speak a little bit, because I know that was a big learning lesson for me, was just that two-person team at the top. Can you speak to a little bit what's that supposed to look like? What is each role supposed to be doing? Because for a lot of people, that might be a new idea of, hey, it's not just supposed to be me. There's supposed to be two of us kind of running this thing. So
I would say it's very typical, Daniel, in most new starts in small businesses, is the visionary and the integrator you'll often find are the same person. And it usually caps the organization. Why? Because the visionary is the one that is thinking of the big ideas. They have 100 ideas in the day and maybe one is worth tracking, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're all great ideas, but maybe only one, when you boil it down, is actually going to get the organization to get traction and move where you need to go. The rest of them can be too much of an issue. So one of the things that often happens is the revelation of who has started or founded the business, and where do they really, where are they at in their own growth and their own weight and burden of the vision that God has put on their heart, and what they understand to do with what the new vision is. So a lot of times the visionary and integrator will be the same person for the kind of the conception and the new part of the business and getting things started. They'll often be the same person. Now, that visionary is going to get worn out because they don't do integration well. They don't do clear messaging well. They want to move on to the next thing. They had the idea, they birthed it, now they want to move on to the next thing. So one of the big things that a visionary that I often look at is starting to understand what character, what kind of skill set does that integrator need to have, and how are they connected to that visionary? Oftentimes, I don't encourage like close relationships often being that one and two person, because you have to have a lot of pushback conversations. And I mean, the only real relationship that I know that has that kind of much pushback is marriage. And it's under the grace of a vow, right? God puts a grace on that vow of two becoming one. A visionary and integrator need to be able to have grace for one another to push each other pretty hard. Because that integrator really has to be able to say, you're sending way too many messages. We need to pull the reins in, and we need to be able to get this pushed out in the organization so that we can see life and sustaining and not move too quickly. So I think that places one, I would tell visionaries of, if you feel stressed about trying to keep the organization going, good. You should be. You should be very stressed about it, and stressed in the right terms. I don't mean that in a negative way, but it should be a discontentment, a dissatisfaction in your leadership, because you're not designed long haul to do that. And I think getting to a person to understand that fulfillment of saying, oh, I need to find someone to come alongside me that wants to carry this. They don't necessarily want a birth vision. They don't necessarily want to think big. They need to understand big picture, but have someone come alongside that you trust. And a trust is a huge portion of the visionary and integrator relationship. I often think of just the Godhead, the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, how they interact. Now, I would say we all understand the fatherhood and kind of the direction that the fatherhood comes, Jesus being the Word, kind of that anchor, but also the companion, and then the Holy Spirit being the edifier, strengthener, encourager that comes along. There's no power play. They're all trying to glorify the other one. And that's really key to this kind of organizational structure. The ones that are really successful understand their role, honor each one, don't do power plays, don't need to get in each other's box, but really let each other flourish. And it often takes time for a visionary to be able to find that person, that integrator, because of the weight of the vision.
How do they find that person?
A lot of times I would say, there is a skill set that you're looking for, but you're also looking for character. You're looking for somebody that has a testimony of sustaining, longevity, devotion to something. So when you're talking about that, a lot of times, in just straight recruiting, like if I'm a part of an organization and I'm looking for, let's say, to fill the COO role of an organization, coming in and really taking the CEO to the next level, and maybe they've been functioning as the CEO and they don't have any C-suite underneath them. It's just been a lot of directors helping them get their business done. And we're looking for that C-suite person. You're going to not only be looking for, the hard skills, right? Understanding of how an operation works and that kind of stuff. You're going to actually be looking for some longevity. You're going to be looking for somebody who's devoted, who hasn't been moving around a lot in their job search. Because what you want to do is you want to find someone that's an anchor. They can settle down and they can create some sense of stability. So you're looking for a lot of character there. You're looking for, people that, in an organization, depending on what kind of organization you're at, you need to be looking at where they're at in their career. You know, are they young and you need a little bit of life to get people on board to some really big high risk reward decisions that you're making as a company? You're growing really fast. So you need someone with a little bit more energy and you know, that is maybe hungry, isn't quite there, but is hungry and coachable. So I'm telling you a lot of skills that you have to look for. The one way that I would say is you find them is you network. You talk to people that you trust. You talk to people that that you know that their organizations that they're around, because people really recognize when you start networking and say, hey, do you know anybody that might fit this? It's amazing how much comes back and goes, oh, you know, I know this person over here. They're really hungry to do that. I wonder where they're at. And you suddenly find out they're ready to make a transition or a move. So to answer your question, it's hard, but you got to know what you're looking for. And then once you know what you're looking for, you can communicate that to your network around you. And also when you're looking through resumes or you're looking through, you know, people are recommending it, you got to have a filter. You got to be ready to understand how to make that decision. So understanding really what you're looking for, characteristics you're looking for is step one. And then I think two would be just networking.
So if someone is, if you're going to bring someone in from outside your organization, can someone jump right into that role, or is there a time period of like building some trust that they got to go through before kind of jumping into that?
You know, I've seen both work. Yeah. You know, an organization that I'm a part of, I'm actually a president of a nonprofit, and we brought in a vice president, completely cold to relationship to me, 100% cold to relationship. He was pretty warm to a few of the counterparts that I've been dealing with. We do develop housing for low-income seniors. So the developer knew of him, knew his character, knew his family. And so I knew by her referral that this was a good person to look at. But for me, it was that person came in, and what it was through interviewing. It was through referrals. It was probably a longer interview process than most. It was a lot more in-depth conversation, having a meal, sharing a meal together, communing together, just seeing how transparent there was, because transparency and authenticity is a huge value for me and the organization that I'm a part of. And so really just trying to create environments that let me get to that quickly if I need to make a decision quickly. If I don't need to make a decision quickly, then by all means, take the time to get in those environments to really be able to talk things out and really see how a person reacts. But if you need to get there quickly, create environments that get you there. You know, if you need to see values, then get them in a situation that makes them demonstrate their values. You know, how does a person react if I cancel on them and have to reschedule last minute? I mean, I know that sounds a little bit manipulative, but it's actually real life. If you need to do that, you need to create gates for people to really be able to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, is what's the day to day when you find this person? What's the day to day? Who's doing what once you figure out this relationship? Who's responsible for what usually?
Yeah, again, that's probably a little bit of progression, but I would give you maybe end story instead of kind of the progressive story. In the beginning, if you're talking vision and integrator meshed together, there's going to be, and I'm going to use some terminology that, I don't know the author of who it comes from, but it's some terminology, some strategic thinking of four quadrants of how to get to some decision making. And it's execution, ideation, planning, and vision, ideation, planning, and execution. And most visionaries, and I'm doing a stereotype and bucketing here, which everybody can get outside of their bucket, everybody can get outside of their lines. But for the most part, visionaries land in between vision. They make decision-making in a very vision execution mindset. So they have an idea and then they go get it done, because who else is going to do it? Who else thinks the way that they do it? So they oftentimes, when you're talking about bringing in an integrator, you have to start spending time talking about decision-making and how things get pushed out into your organization. Because what a visionary has to do is suddenly subject their vision to ideation. Ideation is when you begin to put all the ideas on the table and you begin to filter out and say, hey, these are the top ones. These are the ones that we really want to move forward to. Then it goes into planning. Planning, I would say planning is where the sweet spot of the integrator is, right? You gave me all the great ideas, and now I'm going to plan so that I can get to execution. Integrators and visionaries totally find their sweet spot in execution. We're getting it done. We're getting the results. This is what we want. We're passionate about it. We're excited about it. You'll often see, you know, CEOs and CEOs. I mean, the times where they're both elated is when they had that really big audacious goal and they hit it. Where you see them just conflicted is in ideation. Neither one of them want to do that well. And so you need to have times where you are, you know, intentionally saying, here's the vision. We want to execute, but pause. We got to ideate. And as you ideate, that's when you start discovering, you know, ideation and planning is really when you start discovering the visionary goes, oh, no, I don't want to do this. I don't want to touch this. This can be owned by someone else. And then you have more intentionality of saying, hey, I don't want to own this. You can own this. And this is what you do. So the daily, you know, a visionary is 100% looking at the big picture, innovative thinking, technology, innovation, creating margin for those conversations, a lot of collaborative meetings. I would say probably 80% of their day is thinking, talking to clients, getting more information. You know, probably they're teaching somehow, they're speaking somehow, they're engaged in a kind of a bigger picture. And then 20% is what's happening in the organization and how can I elevate it? How can I get it more in? So that's that time where they're meeting with their integrator saying, hey, integrator, here's the pulse of the organization. Where are we at? Red, green, yellow. Where are we at on our percentages? How are we doing? And then the integrator can walk away with that time that they had together. And the integrator goes back and becomes that leading force in the organization that says, here's the big vision, but man, here's our quarterly goals. And here's where we need to, you know, focus in on. Here's where we need to get lean and mean. And they become kind of the ones that put the direction out. This is what we need to meet this week. This is what we need to do. And the visionary is just popping in and out, creating enthusiasm, creating a bigger picture. Does that color up pretty well?
Yeah. Okay. Now, would you say that some people, I think sometimes we get, you know, in our, the way we think of things, a lot of times everyone thinks, oh, I need to be the visionary. But do you think some people are called to be visionaries and some people are called to be integrators?
Yes. There are, I mean, no one fits into any, you know, we have the ability, I mean, scripturally, I believe that we have the ability to tap in. We have the mind of Christ. Sure. We're created in his image. So we have access to all the tools, all the things necessary in order for us to function in what he's called us to. So there are times in which we lean heavily into the grace to be able to get things done that are a little bit outside of what our skill set is or our calling is in order to be able to go through, you know, forward and do things. You know, I think, I mean, I joke around, but I mean, Jesus is Jesus, but yet he was a carpenter for a while. You know, yeah. he was functioning and doing things that we would be like, really? He's Jesus. And he had to put a chair together, right? But there's the reality of what do we need to learn? How do we need to go through it? And so sometimes there's times when a visionary and integrator, you know, there is that place of having to do things that you don't want to do. A true visionary can integrate in a small amount of time, like a short project. They can do very well on that because they're going to get to their results, right? So they can present themselves as a good integrator, someone that's a strong leader, has characteristics to it. But if you look at it, they're really short window projects. They're not longevity. And that's really what sets a visionary and integrator apart. An integrator goes long. Goes for the long term, can go out to the 10-year vision and pace and keep it going. A visionary will really, they can do really good. Maybe that's a year for some visionaries. Maybe it's a month for others. But you really will see it in the longevity of the vision.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I've seen lately is this idea of, and just in the corporate world, talking to some people of the whoever the leader or lead on the project or whatever it may be, is trying to get some project done, but they don't seem to have exactly or not exactly clear on what they want done, and then they delegate it out and the team is trying to figure it out, and then they keep changing what they want all the time through the project. Is there a way, I guess that's that ideation and planning phase. Is that what we're talking about there? Yeah. You said that's where the magic happens, right?
Yeah, I would say, you know, when you think through planning and vision, it's really hard for visionaries to put too much constraint or boxes around, hey, this is what we're going to do, because it leaves the element of, well, what if I get more knowledge? What if an opportunity comes? What if, you know, it's all that, the stuff that visionaries enjoy, you know, they actually enjoy the what ifs. Most of the organization doesn't enjoy what ifs, right? Because they're responsible at the end of the day for the bottom line, and they're not enjoying the what ifs. And so there's that, it's a very healthy tension. I think one of the key parts of strategic planning is when you give the CEO, if the CEO and is the same as the visionary, I'm using those kind of, I should just use the word visionary. If the visionary is given a lane to swim in, here's your lane. Here's the amount of resources that you get. Here's your lane. Go play. Here's your sandbox. Go play. And that the rest of the team allows that kind of play time to happen. And when they understand anything that kind of comes out of that sandbox is going to be like sand. It can move, it can be molded, it can change. And the team has an understanding that what's coming out of that sandbox isn't devalued because it's moving so much, but rather that's their interaction with it. And then there's a set that comes out of that visionary saying, hey, here are the key, you know, 3 to 5 year initiatives that I want to see happen. Here's the winning moves. If we do these three things, the needle's moving forward and we're hitting to our big audacious goal that we want to hit in 10 years. You know, like, and we all know the big audacious goals, you know, like you want to outdo Nike, you want to have, you know, you want to serve something faster, whatever those big audacious goals are, you put that out there, you come back to about a 3 to 5 year plan. You think of the winning moves, and it's key for the visionary to really be able to say, yes, what I know, here's some key things that will move the needle us closer to do it. And then that's the time when the visionary has to say, here you go, integrator. Here you go. They're yours. You can put a scope, a budget, a timeline around them. And when they get those, then that's when the visionary really has to say, I got my sandbox. And I will help you with these three key initiatives whenever you need them. But you got to give me some time to play, and I will elevate over here. If you get those two mixed, a lot of times that's when the organization gets pulled, and you know, and oftentimes the integrator of the organization gets frustrated because they're trying to plot forward, and if resources are taken or time is taken, which is a very huge resource in an organization, the integrator can get very frustrated because you lose traction. And an integrator, all they're doing is trying to plot forward. So I would say strategic planning really requires buy-in, if I could say that, altogether buy-in. Yeah.
When that whole process, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head earlier, is there's a huge amount of trust that has to happen in that between those two for that handoff to happen. And for one to say, I got it, and the other one to say, all right, you go play in the sandbox. And there's a lot of trust that has to happen for that on both sides for that to happen. So,
yeah. Trust is, I mean, there's, you know, Stephen Covey, I think, probably did the best coin of that, of the speed of trust, you know, understanding that organization moves faster, is more effective when the costs are low, right, and efficiencies are high. I would say the one part of the organizations that everyone kind of gets that on a production model, you know, low cost, get your expenses under order, you know, make sure you've got the right processes and procedures. Where organizations really fail on the speed of trust is thinking about it in the human speed of trust, the trust that's between two individuals on a team, between the CEO and their leadership team, between the leadership team and the rest of the organization. That's become, you know, the huge element of trust. Do I trust what you say? You know, you cast a vision, but you've changed it 3 years in a row. Yeah. How much do I trust what you're going to put behind it? You can still get enthusiasm. you can still get behind charisma. I often talk about, a lot of times people will talk, get excited about growth, but there's a difference between growth and scaling. You know, scaling is being really being able to take something and be able to exponentially get it where you want it to go. You can grow a lot of things, but you don't necessarily have the structure to scale and get to the multiplication level that you want. And an organization just needs to choose. Sometimes all you need to do is grow, and you need to give up scaling, the idea of scaling. You can be happy with growth and maneuvering with growth. And other organizations, part of the key goal is to scale and to multiply and to get different places. So you really got to know a lot about the depth of vision too for trust. It's not just efficiency and processes and procedures.
So you're touching on a little bit the difference between growth and scaling. We haven't talked about this, I don't think, before, but I know one of the things you talk about is multiplication is a kingdom thing. So what's we talk about growth, scaling, multiplication. How do we know when to grow, when to scale? And can you kind of touch on this idea of multiplication a little bit?
Sure. I think one of the key areas that I, you know, when I think of kingdom and you start looking at the principles, you know, one of my two favorite ones to look at is like sow and reap. Multiplication is another one. Anything that you see biblically about God touching is not done in singles. It's always done in multiples, right? So when he expands, or when he returns on talents, when he forgives, like all the things of his nature are exponential. They're not into singular. So when you start thinking this about kingdom, the other part of it is our DNA doesn't know how to replicate. It always is reproducing. And so it's taking pieces, and then there's the difference between Daniel and Leanne. And there's the different, and you see that going forward. And what I think happens is, and I'm kind of going all over the map here a little bit, but another principle that is key is that God creates, and we're in his image, so we're given the ability to create, to put things forth. It's the enemy that doesn't have the ability to create. He only knows how to pervert. So one of the things that he does is he looks at the kingdom, because that's his experience, right? He fell from the kingdom of God. So he looks at it, and that literally is his standard, the kingdom of God and his standard, and he cannot be like him. So the only thing he can do is pervert it. He can only twist it and break it and do something. So he's taken kingdom thought, which is, was, is, and forever will be, a very cyclical mindset. There is no beginning, there is no end in God. And he broke it, and he created linear thought. He created, you know, I shouldn't say he created, he broke it, and he subjects us with linear thought. And what ends up happening is the enemy takes elements of the kingdom. That's the reason why it's so easy to get into the enemy, the snare of the enemy, is because he's taking a truth and perverting it. So anytime that there's a lie present, the truth has to be present already. And I think that's the case a lot in this idea of building businesses and that kind of thing. There's kingdom principles, and then he just bends it slightly to make you go into greed, to make you go into self-preservation, you know, to make you suddenly lose track and go into self-righteousness. You're building something for God. He doesn't need you to build anything, but you're doing it for him anyway, right? Yeah. So the idea is he comes in, he does this. And I think that's one of the places where multiplication and replication is the revelation that I've gotten there, is that the kingdom multiplies. It is, you know, he said, let there be light. What is light still doing? Light is still going. It's still expanding. It's still going out. But what ends up happening is that the enemy comes in, and I believe replication is the enemy's form of trying to expand. I look at Daniel as my standard, and I try to replicate it. Well, that doesn't make any sense according to the kingdom. The kingdom says Daniel has his imprint. Leanne has her imprint. So if I try to live according to the standard of Daniel, I'm not going to flourish. I'm not going to be able to see the fulfillment. And the same thing is in business. If I try to replicate another business that has its unique vision, its unique leaders, its unique sphere of influence, and I say, I'm going to replicate that, I don't have that grace. I'm not under that. And I try to bring that over there. I'm in self-sufficiency. I'm working according to a standard that I'm seeing versus a standard that I've been given. Did I clarify that enough?
And I would say in business, I've been guilty of that many a times in the past. You see that taught a lot. Is you go find a business that's doing well and copy, replicate what they're doing. It's something that's taught, a lot in the world. We're taught to go find people that are doing what's working and just model what they do. But that's not God's way of doing things because we're each unique. It's interesting you're talking about these circles, but I don't think we've talked about it yet. But so inside of the Abundant Life Blueprint, one of the things that we've started working on over the last couple months is this idea. There's actually four circles in it that expand in there, and they kind of encompass multiple rooms on the house type of thing, and they kind of make them complete. Touch on that idea of the circles a little bit more that you were talking about there. You said no beginning, no end.
I think the image that I had, when pursuing the kingdom and understanding the basis of where this is coming from is, in order for me to establish the kingdom or to be like God, I become what I look at. So what am I looking at? What nature am I looking at? The nature of God that I'm looking at. And he says of himself, there is no beginning and there is no end. The idea of the kingdom of God is eternal. There isn't a beginning and there isn't an end. And so I was in him, I am in him, and I forever will be in him. And so in that mindset, I can in any moment talk about my past, my present, and my future. God can connect any one of those dots. And being able to look at that mindset of going, okay, that means healing can happen. That's how inner healing works, right? It's inner healing says in this moment, I can go back and redeem this moment in the now moment so that your moments that are ahead of you will be walking in redemption and restoration. But there is no linear pathway for that. So at no moment is Daniel further ahead in the kingdom than Leanne or Crystal being ahead of Daniel. It's literally we are in where we are in the Lord, and the understanding of it is his mindset is I was, I am, and forever be. This is the mind-blowing way that I think about it. When he looks at me in the internal state. That's how he sees me. His son came so that he would only see me through the eternal state. So he's never calling us or speaking to us on the lack. He's always speaking to us on the abundance. That's the reason why I think he can say, I came for life and life abundantly, is because I literally see you and I've commissioned you according to the eternal abundance, not according to your linear path on earth. Yeah, and that
you are right now.
Yeah, I mean, that dichotomy is where we begin to go, okay, when we look at it, then we have to start thinking, well, what is eternal thinking then? You know, it's like, I joke around, it's that hope for a future, not hope for a rapture, right? It's that idea of my thinking isn't about, I can't wait till I get saved, or God save me from this moment. It is, I can't wait to see how salvation works its way out right now. And so it becomes that place of, he is the deliverer. He is the restorer. He is the redeemer. If he is those things, then my life perspective is, I can't wait to see those things manifest. Can you imagine in your business coming in every day with the idea of, I can't wait to see abundance unveiled today versus what do I need to change? What do I need to discipline myself into so that I can perform my way into abundance? Instead, going, abundance is mine. How do I usher that in? Because that's an eternal mindset. I've been set apart. I've been proven perfect. And so when you look at that kind of cyclical thinking of what eternal mindset is versus linear says, I got to hit all these marks. I'm jealous because I see this person's over here. I'm back here. I feel this way. That person feels that way. I'm less than. I mean, those are all linear thoughts. Those are not kingdom thoughts. So a real approach of kingdom, especially in business, is what is the imprint that you're trying to fulfill? What is the eternal imprint that you're trying to fulfill? Especially when leaders that are faith-based want to fulfill the glory of God in their lives, want to go to glory to glory. That's a key question that I ask, is really, what's the imprint? What's the end game? Meaning, what's the internal cry that is inside of you? And then how is that, how are you using your business to leverage that, to manifest that?
So it sounds like, you know, the non-kingdom way is to replicate and copy what everybody else is doing, but we're supposed to be set apart and unique, which is almost like, kind of like the DNA example, like each, our businesses are supposed to have their unique DNA. I don't know if we've talked about this, but one of the things that I've learned about DNA, it's in the Cracking Heaven's Code book, is that DNA only has four building blocks. There's just four. Like, you got four colors of blocks, and I forget what the letters are, but like only A and G can go together, and only C and T can go together. And the way you get so many different people in the world is you just change the ordering of how the blocks are stacked. As the only difference is all the same blocks. It's just the way you change the ordering of them, gives you all the uniqueness of people. And I'm learning that same thing even about music. I've been getting into playing, guitar a little bit, and you know, there's only so many basic chords, but it's just the way that you rearrange the order or how many strums on this one, or, you know, that gives you all the differences in the songs with just a few basic, chords. And we've even been implementing that principle into workouts of just taking basic stuff and just playing around with the pieces. So how does that fit into the business we're talking about here?
No, I think, it was funny, just the phrase went through my head as we're talking, Daniel, there's nothing new underneath the sun. Yeah. You know, that when it comes to business tactics, you started out the conversation with it. There's a plethora of do it this way, do it that way, you know, try this, try that. When you boil it all down, there's some just basics. I mean, there's just some plain old basics. It's just a matter of integrating, you know, who are you? What is that imprint that God's given you? How do you manifest that imprint? For example, you know, one of the key things that I learned for me is I've got a lot of tool sets. In the faith space, I can get a lot of names put on me, you know, that she's prophetic, or she could, or, you know, this, that, you know, all these different things. The reality of it is I have a desire, an imprint in me to influence the influential. Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that because I pursued the Lord in that, but the building blocks inside me, the rest of it is just tools for help for me to leverage doing that. For another person, they could have a very specific saying, you know, I want to build something that literally helps humanity. Like, there's a passion that says, I want to build something that I can craft something that helps humanity. Well, they can have similar giftings, but they now have a different vision. They have a different part of the imprint that's going. They've got a unique personality, but some of the building blocks are the same. The tools are the same. Yeah. We're just leveraging them to go to a vision. So part of it is, who are you in the Lord? You know, what is he, how does he want to express you? Because, you know, he's decided the best version of what I'm supposed to express in the earth is supposed to be in a female body. There is no male, no female in the kingdom of God. But here on earth, to manifest his glory, he decided that it was best that I come in female form with the tools that I have. And so that is another building block that I have of how am I to integrate and move through that and do that. So I think part of it is you understand who you are. You understand that the tools that are in front of you, maybe you need to spend some time discovering more tools. I mean, maybe some of the reason why you're struggling in business is because you think you only have one or two tools when he's given you access to multitudes of different tools, different gifts, different ways to use those gifts, you know, and understanding of doing. I swing a hammer very different than my dad, but we both get a nail in.
Yeah.
Right? You know? And so I think the reality of understanding what that tool is and what I do with it. And then the last piece to that would be the vision, like where's that end game? And so when you talk about those building blocks, that's how I would see the building blocks, you know, that very personal, the tools, and then the end game vision.
So you got your personal imprint, what tools are you using? And then your end game vision,
mm-hmm.
the three basic ones. Huh? Okay.
Yeah. And I would say the same for business. I mean, if you think about it in business, you're talking about what is your niche, right? Mm-hmm. What is your key thing that is in this space? You're talking about, you know, what is not only your skill set, what is your unique skill set? Why is your niche going to work? What's the value proposition? And then you're looking at the last piece of what are you really going to do with those two things? The niche that you have, the product that you have, your value proposition, and then where are you going to go with it? So it's the same, you're going to use the same principles. You're going to set up an organization. You're going to have a leader. You're going to have resources. You're going to have production. You're going to have to do finances. You know, all the building blocks are there, but those three key components set you apart from the next person.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to put you on the spot here a little bit. Sorry for doing
this. Oh, no.
So when you do coaching, so when you go in and you got a new coaching client, I know you're kind of going in and you're looking for certain things. Like, so what's sit down with somebody for the first time and you're kind of evaluating their business. Where do we start? What are we looking for? What are some things that people could start? You know, we'll kind of show them like, this is where we get started type of thing.
Yeah. The interesting part is you ask me a question that I don't know that I have the fullness of understanding what to do, because I've actually put myself in coaching situations where I've like, this is the one place that I've needed coaching, especially there's quite a few areas in coaching, but this is one of them, is trying to understand what I call Leanne's secret sauce. Like, what's the difference between, my coaching versus another. In all coaching, you want to help either you as a coach, you're doing gap analysis, you're doing discovery. Where's the gap? Where are step A and B not connected? Where is A, where is Z? Like, you've got to get all of your boundaries. You've got to understand what's the framework that I'm working in. And when you start understanding the framework, that's what I would call the first step of coaching, is really understanding the framework. What is the goal of the person? You know, as the coach, I need to understand what the goal of the person is. I need to begin to understand how they communicate. So putting them in a scenario where I'm learning their communication style. I'm learning how they learn. I'm learning how they think. I'm learning how they feel. I'm learning how they've processed things in the past. I'm learning their obstacles. So it's a lot of discovery of what I would call framework.
Okay.
You know, putting context to what this relationship's going to be. Because the idea of coaching is there's got to be relational capital. I've got to create a bridge that says, as we continue this conversation, I have to somehow gain permission from you to ask you hard questions and give you the opportunity to get to an answer that in and of yourself you haven't gotten to, or you haven't admitted you've gotten to. Mm-hmm. And so bringing it out of the unconscious into the conscious. And in order to do that, you've got to create trust, which is a huge, I think, probably key word to our conversation today in totality, is really how do you build trust and how do you create that? But for coaching, first step going in is really analysis of listening really, really well. I mean, basic coaching principle, right, is not doing what I'm doing today, which is don't talk so much.
You're on the other side.
Is listening, right? Is making sure that you're doing active listening, is clarifying. Because a person often will give you what they think you want to hear. Even as a coach, you can come into a coaching relationship and or a counseling relationship, and you think, oh, this person knows I'm here to help them. They still will answer you the way they think they're supposed to answer you. They'll filter it through all of their precepts. You know, there's called a communication complex that we go through, you know, all these different gates that we go through within milliseconds, and we come out and communicate according to those different filters. And a key element for a coach is to understand how to segment those different filters of the communication complex. You know, what filters, what has happened throughout their life, what experiences have they had, what standards are they holding against themselves, and again, what I mentioned before, how do they think, feel, you know, process these kind of things. So the first step, even in business consulting, it's just discovery, gap analysis, having lots of conversations. You know, what is your viewpoint? Where do you think your hindrances are? Where do you think you should be? You know, what told you you should be there? How did you, you know, how did you standardize that? And so really kind of getting to know an organization before asking more in-depth questions, because there's, you got to be careful as a coach not to have assumptions. I mean, we all have assumptions going in. We have intuition. We have discernment. Good coaches have discernment. That's the reason why they're coaches. They can kind of, you know, quickly dissect and go, okay, that's probably what the issue is. But a good coach has to put assumptions on the side and really ask some questions to get down to some roots.
Okay. Okay. So a lot of it is you're going in trying to build trust. You're trying to get to know the person. And then you're looking at where are the gaps. So what are, and I'm going to open us up for questions here in just a second, but what are some of the biggest gaps that you see? Some of the glaring ones that are usually pretty common.
In business, I would say the wrong people in the wrong seats would be one of the biggest gaps.
Okay.
What I mean by wrong people is, I mean, they can be incredibly talented, skilled people. They either got into the seat because they didn't know better, or the people around them said, I need you to do this. Can you wear this hat? And they've got into it because they leveraged relationship. So a lot of time you see people in the wrong position. You just don't see people thriving, either out of their own lack of self-awareness or naivety, or it's out of an organization leveraging talent because they need to. They just, yes. And I would say to you that a lot of times I have to help leaders understand how they're not taking care of their people well, that they're leveraging the skills for their own benefit versus really helping that person step into what they're really good at and what they thrive at. Because if you get a person that's good at something, they love to do it, they're going to work and produce 100 times more than someone that you think has a skill and you try to squeeze everything out of them. And so there's that gap analysis. I would say another one that I see a lot of times in the organization is there's no strategic plan. There's just lots of ideas, lots of hopes, lots of dreams floating around. But when it comes down to it, they're just functioning on fire, 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 fire. So getting an organization out of reaction into response. How are we responding? What are our anchors? That's the big one that I would say for gaps. And then I would probably say another gap would just be, especially for smaller businesses, is it kind of goes twofold for me. It's one, rooting down and understanding, do you really believe you can be successful? Or are you just trying to, make it meet? Do you know what I mean? Because you end up not making great financial decisions. So I would say that's another big gap analysis that I do. It's just looking at how finances are being handled, how risk reward, the decision of making around risk reward, and weighing those decisions. So on the spot, that's what I would come up with.
Yeah, no, those are good. Well, this has been great. I thank you for doing here. I'm going to open it up here, and we can have a little bit more discussion here, but we can open it up. I'm going to unmute here.